Okay, and thank you for supporting Counterspin on Champaign-Urbana's WEFT, Champaign-Urbana and Environs. Better change it up a little bit, 90.1 FM on your dial, on your app, on your computer, whatever, your device of choice. Harry Shearer's Year in Rebuke. I was going to sample some of his satire through the hour as a middle of the week holiday. This is closest I'm getting to New Year's Eve, and we've got a brand new year with a code red situation, kidnapping of Maduro. Interesting that Noriega was kidnapped a couple of decades ago this summer. That would have been Bush 1. He was trying to break the Vietnam syndrome, make the military seen as a useful tool again. That was illegal too, of course. Heard some of Democratic senators calling this an illegal act. I was thinking back on the Noriega stuff and found this accusation that he had cocaine in his freezer. Military reassessed it and said it was some kind of paste substance used for voodoo rituals, which was probably wrong too. It was probably a manioc paste used in cooking in the regions. But it's definitely overstimulating times, and I was going to do sort of an internal music show with some information about nuclear power from Harvey Wasserman's Green Power Wellness podcast, which isn't on Apple Podcasts. Maybe he's boycotting it, but you might Google that and see if you can find it. Carl Grossman, exceptional journalist, not the rigorous scientist. He makes some mistakes over the years, but his overall analysis of the nuclear industry and regulation or lack thereof, more than ever. Under the deregulatory Trump regime. That's close to the title of my article in the Public Eye. I was going to mention that we don't have the Public Eye latest edition. It's only out on the shelf. We were sort of semi-hacked. Somebody tried to break into our WordPress so much that we were blocked out of it, and we have to go into some administrative rigmarole to get access to it. And the wizard that does our editing and stuff was not able to overcome that. Holidays and being a grandfather and stuff, I guess. Thanks, Rick. So it's not up. I was going to cite the article about anti-Semitism in the light of all of the furor about Mamdani rescinding all of Adam's executive orders. They got executive orders too at the New York mayoralty. All of the ones following his indictment, which was a clever way to putting them all together, including the ones about adopting a standard for anti-Semitism that equates anti-Zionism and anti-Israeli policy almost with anti-Semitism. That's in the article that you can only find in paper by some local CU Jews for a Ceasefire. But soon it'll be up on the IMC page, Public Eye page, and you can look for my nuclear power article. I had the thought of pressing a button here and getting back over to the mic and wondering whether it would be possible to hear some of the lies of Trump. His press conference. I'm sure it's not going to start on time. They probably have to arrange Maduro's photo op in shackles with his wife. C-SPAN doesn't have it. I figured that would be the easiest place to get it from. I don't think I want to do it anyway. I was thinking about doing a mystery science theater treatment of his news conference and sort of like do a talk over reality check as it goes. Anyway, No Mumia, it was good to hear. This is my usual feature, if it's available, a Mumia Abu Jamal commentary. It was good to hear him in that roundup from Fairness and Accuracy and Reporting Counterspin. Well, PBS NewsHour doesn't have the presser yet, I don't think. Looks like it's not active. They're still waiting on him at Mar-a-Lago. You know, why doesn't he change the name to something in English? What has he got a Spanish name for his resort for? You know? We've got to purge that. Okay, I have what I think is sad news. My other regular feature is Amy Goodman's commentary, and I can't tell from her posting and from this piece here whether she's ending it or not. Maybe her colleague that works on it with her is retiring or something, or the grant money ran out or something like that. I'll listen to it again with you and decide whether indeed she's calling it quits or breaking the sound barrier. I wrote her and said, please don't stop it. I use it every week. I have to find something else. Maybe I go back to Black Agenda Report, but they don't do audio every week. They do post a lot of interesting stuff, and I used to run that regularly when there was a regular weekly column for the radio or for the audio. So Amy Goodman, I didn't do the main feature. The main feature is from Dropsite, if I don't get to the presser from Trump on this occasion. Radio Free Labor coming up. I'm sure the Gus will have a lot on this. His discourse has been that Trump's pretty much a paper tiger, but I guess maybe other people are saying that, and he has to be a war president after all. Who'd have thunk it? So here's Amy's perhaps final Breaking the Sound Barrier column. Say it ain't so.
Breaking the Sound Barrier. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. We've been writing this weekly column for close to 20 years. This one will be our last syndicated by King Features. We've aspired to stay true to this column's original intent to break the sound barrier, highlighting voices excluded from the corporate media, covering the movements that drive change, and holding to account those in power regardless of political party. One goal, in addition to serving our readers and the newspapers that have long carried the column, has been to inspire other journalists to pick up our stories. We call this trickle-up journalism, centering grassroots struggles that are too often marginalized in our civic discourse. While we leave this particular platform of weekly syndication, our work continues, as demanded by the tenor of these times. Democracy Now!, the TV, radio, internet news hour we produce each weekday, turned 30 years old in February. Carried on over 1,500 stations around the globe, and with a growing audience of millions across multiple digital platforms, the program has become a leader in the burgeoning nonprofit news space as we collectively grapple with a multi-pronged crisis in journalism. In November, Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism released its 2025 State of Local News report. Using data compiled over 20 years, Medill reports that since 2005, close to 3,500 newspapers have ceased printing. In the same period, more than 270,000 newspaper jobs, 75% of the total, have disappeared, with fewer than 100,000 remaining. As the role of print journalism changes, many people, and especially young people, turn to the digital realm for news. The Pew Research Center recently reported that 38% of those ages 18 to 29 get news from news influencers, unquote. That is, not reporters, but people who have large followings on social media. Content there is notoriously unvetted, subject to increasingly sophisticated artificial intelligence or AI fabrications and distortions, and favored for distribution by black box algorithms unleashed on the planet by a small circle of immensely powerful corporations like Google, Facebook, and Elon Musk's X. The climate for journalists is eroding as well. President Donald Trump regularly denounces the press as the enemy of the people.
Because the media, those people right there, they're corrupt, largely corrupt. They are truly the enemy of the people. They are.
Trump's violent rhetoric has real-world consequences as his followers verbally abuse, harass, and even physically assault reporters. When asked by ABC's Rachel Scott about releasing footage of the Pentagon's lethal September double-tap strike on a boat in the Caribbean, Trump replied,
"You said that it was
up
to Secretary Hexler.
You're the most obnoxious reporter in the whole place. Let me just tell you, you are an obnoxious, a terrible reporter."
Trump recently called CBS's Nancy Cordes stupid.
"Are you stupid? Are you a stupid person?"
Katie Rogers from The New York Times, ugly. And when Catherine Lucy of Bloomberg News asked him about releasing the Epstein files, Trump told her, "Quiet, Piggy." Attacks on women journalists were a focus of the United Nations on November 2nd, International Day to End Impunity for Crimes Against Journalists, noting, quote, 73% of the women journalists surveyed said they'd been threatened, intimidated, and insulted online in connection with their work, unquote. The Committee to Protect Journalists counted 126 journalists and media workers killed in 2025. An enormous toll. Gaza remains the most dangerous place for journalists, with Israel's slaughter of Palestinian reporters reaching unprecedented levels, well over 200 since October 2023. Mexico, Sudan, and Yemen have also been lethal for journalists. Despite this grim picture, there are signs of hope. Medill counted, quote, close to 700 standalone digital sites, more than 850 network-operated digital sites, more than 650 ethnic and foreign language organizations, unquote. Journalistic entities springing up to fill the voids left as traditional business models that supported journalism for centuries collapse. As we mark Democracy Now!'s 30th anniversary, we'll be traveling across the United States, touring with a remarkable new documentary about Democracy Now! Named after one of our NewsHour's mottos, Steal This Story, Please, directed by the Oscar-nominated filmmakers Tia Lesson and Carl Diehl. We'll be holding fundraisers for public television and radio stations as they reel from the Trump administration's abrupt cancellation of federal funding and reporting on how people are organizing in their own communities. Democracy Now! Started at the Pacifica Radio Network, founded in 1949 to provide an alternative to the increasingly commercialized media landscape that, as the late George Gerbner of the Annenberg School of Communication once said, have nothing to tell and everything to sell that are raising our children today, unquote. We really do think that those who care about war and peace— those who care about racial, economic, and social justice, about LGBTQ plus issues, and about the climate catastrophe are not a fringe minority, not even a silent majority, but the silenced majority silenced by the corporate media. It's our job to go to where the silence is, to be the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
So now my impression is that the print version of this essay is what's stopping. So write her and ask her to keep doing it if you've enjoyed this, and ask her to consider a stop here and see you. I guess there'll be some people working on the screening of the film. If we can't get her to visit, maybe our sibling station, WL, would countenance cooperating and bringing in here, too. She might draw some money for them. But WEFT and the Independent Media Center would be glad to host her, I'm sure. So send her a note. I will. Okay, I'm going to check back here and see if C-SPAN is offering the talk. I just read on a website that it actually isn't going to be coming up shortly, that it'll be 3 o'clock Florida time. I guess they're getting the set ready. Maybe they'll have some confiscated drugs. Did I say either in Noriega's? But yeah, right. Okay. I'm sure I'll have something on this tomorrow. I wouldn't be surprised if Amy Goodman does a special if she doesn't have her agenda too much for the weekend. Maybe Greg Grandin, who on Facebook has been posting stuff about this, Tariq Ali, who has contacts in the Caracas government, the Venezuelan government, and some leftists on the outside as well. I guess I'm going to press this and see. No, they're still showing an empty podium. But I guess it does mean that it is going ahead sometime soon. Just as well, I guess the lies will come out, posturing. He'll probably meander off and do a weave, you know, like I am right now. So let's hear a bit of the, I did this last week, but this is in a different voice. This is the Drop Site article about Jeffrey Epstein's ties to Iran-Contra. While major corporate media are ignoring the intelligence connections, can't say Mossad, can't say CIA, can't say the both of them working together to ship weapons to Iran to get hostages out in Lebanon. And it's all ancient history, but, you know, it's part of Epstein's role that isn't being looked at. And I thought it was worthy or checking again. So I'm going to do that now, and let's see if everything's ready to go here. I think there's a little musical bed we'll check with that. Yeah.
Epstein, Israel, and the CIA. How the Iran-Contra planes landed at Les Wexner's base. Jeffrey Epstein helped Leslie Wexner repurpose the CIA's Iran-Contra planes from arms smuggling to shipping lingerie. By Ryan Grimm, Murtaza Hussein, Harrison Berger. This week, the New York Times awoke from its slumber to publish an extensive investigation on Jeffrey Epstein that purported to put to rest the question of how the man made his money early in his career. In it, the Times dismisses the possibility that Epstein could have worked for or adjacent to intelligence agencies. Abundant conspiracy theories hold that Epstein worked for spy services or ran a lucrative blackmail operation. But we found a more prosaic explanation for how he built a fortune, the paper wrote. To the paper's credit, their journalists have put into the record some details that took an impressive effort to track down. For instance, the paper reported about Epstein's business associates in the early 1980s. Epstein had been spending extravagantly, and despite his lofty compensation at Bear Stearns and his work for Douglas Lease, he found himself strapped, even occasionally bouncing rent checks. Back in New York, he joined forces with John Stanley Pottinger, a lawyer who had recently left a senior post in the Justice Department. Epstein, Pottinger and Pottinger's brother rented a penthouse office in the Hotel St. Moritz on Central Park South. The broker, Joanna Cutler, told us that Epstein initially stiffed her on the commission. The Times deserves credit, we suppose, for digging up that nugget from his one-time broker. But had the paper decided to look up rather than look down, they may have noticed something a bit more revelatory in their own reporting. Stanley Pottinger, as it happens, was a notable figure in the scandal that became known as Iran-Contra, in which the CIA used Israel as a middleman to move off the books weapons to Iran. In the early 1980s, under the CIA's supervision, Pottinger advised an Iranian banker on shipping embargoed arms to Iran using fraudulent paperwork in overseas dummy companies. In the very same period that Pottinger and Epstein worked together selling tax avoidance strategies from a penthouse by Central Park, Pottinger's system eventually gave rise to a network of covert intermediaries shipping arms around the world. The CIA's profits became a slush fund used to illegally bankroll the insurgent Contra Army, who waged a war against Nicaragua's leftist government while simultaneously trafficking cocaine to the United States. The other figure from Epstein's past, Douglas Leese, meanwhile, is described by the Times as a defense contractor with extensive connections in the arms industry and the British government. What he did with those connections and where he trafficked those arms is left unexplored by the paper. A look at Bermuda financial records and Leese's own lawsuit filed in the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Miami suggests he was working with the U.S. government and linked to a Chinese arms manufacturer. The Times also failed to note that Epstein and Leese had a mutual associate in Adnan Khashoggi, the notorious money launderer and weapons trafficker, who was also a central player in the Iran-Contra affair. The Times did find that Epstein was a relentless scammer who abused expense accounts, engineered inside deals, and demonstrated a remarkable knack for separating seemingly sophisticated investors and businessmen from their money. The contrast between what the Times found noteworthy about his relationship with his penthouse mate Pottinger, he initially stiffed the broker, and what they failed to notice is stark. In order to acquit Epstein of any connections to intelligence agencies, the paper of record instead crafted Epstein into an anti-Semitic caricature of historic proportions. We put this take to the Times and were told by spokesperson Danielle Rhodes Ha, "We report on facts that we are able to confirm, not supposition." Of course, it could be an extraordinary coincidence that Epstein shared a penthouse with an Iran-Contra lawyer, worked for an Iran-Contra arms dealer, and then, as we report below, moved the Iran-Contra planes to Ohio for use by billionaire retail mogul Leslie Wexner. It may simply be a coincidence that Ehud Barak, one of Epstein's closest friends, was the head of Israel's military intelligence during the planning for Iran-Contra, and he supervised the CIA's first delivery. But it might also be something the Times should look a bit closer at, if they're so inclined.
Okay, that's an interesting 4 minutes or so of that piece. I think I am going to play more of that because I find it engaging. I didn't check back in the last 2 minutes or so, but as far as I can tell, the podium is still empty down in Mar-a-Lago. So let's listen to Trump. I'm sure he'll sing this at his ballroom at some point in his term.
Let me take you on a journey, just an unbelievable trip, down to your personal cabana, your own plot on the Gaza Strip. There's a beautiful view of the ocean, weather to make you flip. Pesky Palestinians, just you and the Gaza Strip. It's a tabula rasa, whatever the hell that means. It's a fabulous five-star plaza, so I'll meet you down in Gaza. Will be in all the magazines. There'll be some talk of protests, but they'll just be a blip. Leave it all to the valet at your mansion on the Gaza Strip. Out Rivieraing the Riviera, no taxes on any tip. You'll enjoy the classiest strippers down on the Gaza Strip. It's a tabula rasa, whatever the hell that means. It's a fabulous five-star plaza, so I'll meet you down in Gaza. We'll get you there by any means. This is LeSean.
And that's Harry Shearer. I mentioned, I warned you, I was going to play some Year in Rebuke. That was his December 28th episode. I've got some news of the atom that I planned on queuing up before I go into my anti-nuclear segment, which maybe I'll get to. The podium is still empty. And like I said, I heard, read somewhere that it wasn't going to be three until three in the afternoon after all. If you don't know what I'm talking about, Special Forces went in and kidnapped Maduro and his wife. So, almost on the anniversary of Bush 1 kidnapping Noriega. I guess he wanted to upstage him, do it a little earlier, have more forces involved. Actually, much less force. There were many people killed in Panama, and we don't know the results yet. There were some injuries to U.S. Special Forces, so all minor, of course. We've heard, using the Imperial we. So, I guess I'm going to put some things together tomorrow. Like I was hoping a special Democracy Now! Greg Grandin interview. But let's return to Drop Site News. Epstein, Israel, and the CIA, how the Iran-Contra planes landed at Les Wexner's airbase in Ohio. Repurposed them for Victoria's Secret and another major label whose name I can't remember. Not lingerie. Excuse me, I'm having breakfast. Let's see if I've got this queued up in the right place here. I knew there was a little sort of fundraising interlude. We can always use community media. Dropsite News is allowing me to give away a couple of month trial subscriptions, so if you want to try it out, contact me, and I haven't picked out but a couple of people so far. Deductible to the extent permitted by law. And this isn't Ryan Grimm. This might be a synthetic voice. I don't know. It's pretty good, though.
Epstein's Yahoo email cache was vetted and published by DDoS. You can find much of the inbox here. We're adding new emails every week. How the Iran-Contra planes landed at Les Wexner's base. Jeffrey Epstein helped Leslie Wexner repurpose the CIA's Iran-Contra planes from arms smuggling to shipping lingerie. When a Southern Air transport plane was shot down over Nicaragua in October 1986, the world got a rare window into U.S. government covert activity. Southern Air Transport was founded as a small cargo airline in 1947, the same year the Office of Strategic Services evolved into the Central Intelligence Agency, as the U.S. pivoted to a Cold War posture. The agency owned the airline outright from 1960 until 1973, at which point it was sold to the same man, Stanley G. Williams, who had run the company since the Kennedy administration. The downing of the plane, and the testimony of its lone survivor, Eugene Hasenfuss, pulled a string that eventually unraveled the scandal known as Iran-Contra. Using Southern Air transport planes, the CIA was shipping weapons to Iran, using Israel as a middleman, and deploying the profits to arm the Contras against the leftist Nicaraguan government. None of it was legal, and Southern Air Transport was getting too hot. In need of a new mission, the company relocated its headquarters from Miami, Florida, to Columbus, Ohio, By 1995, the company had rebranded by flying imported shipments of clothing from China. But for 3 years in Columbus, the airline continued to be dogged by rumors it had been, or was still, involved in smuggling. According to veteran Columbus journalist Bob Fetrakis, who provided his historical reporting on the topic to Drop Site and the American Conservative, investigators in both the Franklin County Sheriff's Office and Ohio's Office of Inspector General were looking into Southern air transport amid rising public scrutiny of the Iran-Contra affair. And sources in both offices identified Jeffrey Epstein as having a pivotal role in relocating the planes. At the time, Epstein was a relatively obscure financier managing the money and real estate investments of Ohio-based fashion and retail mogul Leslie Wexner. Under his stewardship of the Wexner Empire, the planes that previously carried arms to Iran and Nicaragua were repurposed to deliver clothes to feed Wexner's network of retail chains, including Victoria's Secret and Abercrombie & Fitch. Southern Air Transport abruptly declared bankruptcy on October 1, 1998, exactly 1 week before the CIA Inspector General released its official findings on the Iran-Contra affair linking the airline to allegations of Contra cocaine trafficking from Nicaragua. Under pressure from the governor's office, Ohio officials dropped their inquiries, meaning that Epstein's role never became public. How did Epstein end up moving the former Contra planes to Columbus? Answering that question, or at least getting close, requires a closer look at the men behind the scandal that defined the second half of the Reagan administration and gave the public the clearest look inside the U.S. government's clandestine global operations in a generation or more. Like a spy service Forrest Gump, Jeffrey Epstein can be found there every leg of the way. Finding hidden money. In 1981, Jeffrey Epstein resigned from Bear Stearns amid suspicions of insider trading and began traveling regularly to London, where he grew close with the family of Douglas Leese, a British businessman with a long career in auto and aerospace manufacturing. Epstein became Douglas Leese's protege and fast friends with his sons Nicholas and Julian, according to a podcast interview later given by the latter. After World War II, Douglas Leese had been managing director of his father's company, Cam Gears, a steering gear manufacturer that supplied Jaguar, Ford, Nissan, and other global auto brands. In 1965, the company was sold to TRW, a U.S. aerospace conglomerate known for satellites and intercontinental ballistic missiles. 1979 was a revolutionary year in the Persian Gulf. Saddam Hussein became president of Iraq and swiftly executed and imprisoned his political rivals, while across Iraq's eastern border, the people of Iran overthrew the CIA-backed Shah. During Iran's revolution, university students seized the U.S. embassy in Tehran and took Americans as hostages, leading the U.S. to impose harsh economic and military sanctions. The CIA planned to fuel a war between Iran and Iraq to ensure neither Saddam Hussein nor Ayatollah Khomeini could gain control of the Strait of Hormuz, while keeping the Soviet Navy out as protector of the Gulf. But the hostage crisis had added a wrinkle to their plans. After the 1979 revolution, the U.S. was prohibited from selling weapons to Iran, as any overt weapons deals would violate an official arms embargo and undermine President Ronald Reagan's public position that America did not bargain with terrorists. Instead, in a strategy aimed at reducing Soviet influence with Iran, the CIA tacitly supported weapons sales from China, and Beijing began shipping armaments to both Iran and Iraq in 1980. In spring 1983, Iran signed a $1.3 billion arms deal with China. These weapons were supplied in part by Chinese manufacturing conglomerate Norinco, using British Hong Kong as the transshipment point. Douglas Leese, at the time, owned a Bermuda holding company, LORAD. Soon after the Iran arms deal was signed, a new LORAD entity, a shell company called Norinco LORAD, was formed in Bermuda. A Hong Kong trading company called LORAD Far East followed a few months later. Leese's exact role in China's weapons sales has never been made public. But in 1995, a British MP, George Galloway, in fact, alleged Leese had clandestinely funded Middle East arms deals using a Bermuda bank. That year, the owners of British retail chain Littlewoods raised alarm bells about Leese's arms trafficking ties after the company received a proposal for Norinco to sell washing machines to Littlewoods and weapons to LORAD. 2 years later, in a U.S. civil complaint against the Littlewoods owners, Lease claimed his work concerned highly sensitive projects believed to be classified by the Department of Defense and other agencies of the United States government. Meanwhile, the CIA prepared its own covert pipeline to ship American-made weapons to Iran. In the fall of 1980, the FBI placed Cyrus Hashemi, an Iranian banker, under extensive electronic surveillance, recording tens of thousands of conversations over a five-month span. The tapes revealed that John Stanley Pottinger, Hashemi's attorney, was helping the Iranians circumvent the arms embargo using phony invoices and overseas shell companies. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee later found that the CIA was involved in planning the arms deals and had met with Hashemi in Pottinger's office. Pottinger, it turns out, was working together with Epstein in New York. Pottinger had previously served as an assistant attorney general under President Richard Nixon. Now he joined up with another crook, and the two men rented a penthouse office together on Central Park South, according to the New York Times. The Times reported that Pottinger and Epstein were pitching tax avoidance strategies for wealthy clients and noted that the business partnership was short-lived. In 1984, Pottinger was identified in a federal indictment against Hashemi for illegal arms exports, and Hashemi fled to England. Pottinger escaped prosecution after the FBI's incriminating tapes of his conversations mysteriously disappeared. He went on to make a fortune on real estate deals in the 1980s, and became a New York Times best-selling novelist. His Times obit from last year reports that his final spy thriller remains unpublished. Hashemi died in 1986 after being infected with a rare and virulent form of leukemia that was diagnosed only 2 days before he died. His death was later alleged to be foul play. After Hashemi's indictment, another player stepped into broker access to Iran for the Americans, Saudi arms dealer Adnan Khashoggi, uncle of slain Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi. In July 1985, Hashemi, Khashoggi, and Israeli Prime Minister Shimon Peres had met secretly in Hamburg, West Germany, to hatch a plot. With CIA Director William Casey's blessing, the U.S. would ship the weapons to Israel, Israel would sell its own weapons to Iran, and Washington would commit to replenishing Israel's stockpile later. Epstein obtained an Austrian passport with a false name and an address in Saudi Arabia at some time in the 1980s. After his arrest in 2019, U.S. authorities discovered it in a safe in his New York mansion. At a bail request hearing, Epstein's attorneys claimed it came from a friend, intended to conceal his Jewish identity in case of a potential kidnapping while traveling. Seven Americans, including a CIA officer, were kidnapped in Lebanon between 1984 and 1985, and discussions emerged around an arms for hostages trade with Iran. After Peres agreed to facilitate Khashoggi's shipments to Iran, the logistics were handled by Israeli military intelligence. Epstein's close friend and confidant, Ehud Barak, was the head of Israel's Military Intelligence Directorate, Amman, during the planning phases from April 1983 to September 1985. He left the position 1 month after the first arms shipment was completed. To this day, Barak maintains that he was introduced to Epstein by Shimon Peres at a public event in 2003 after he left government service. Barak has also falsely claimed that he barely knew Epstein. Whether they truly met before 2003 is unknown. The Israeli arms pipeline depended on a fragile trust. The Israelis wanted cash up front, but the Iranians would only pay after the weapons were delivered. Acting as the bank, using accounts at the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, BCCI, Khashoggi advanced tens of millions of dollars in credit so that weapons could move even when the parties did not trust each other. Gaith Faron, a Stanford-educated businessman close to the Saudi royal family, acquired regional banks and distressed insurance companies in the U.S. to loop BCCI into U.S. financial markets. The CIA shielded BCCI from federal investigators to conceal the money trail to their illicit arms deals. BCCI operated as a Cayman Islands entity structured as a charitable trust, funneling capital into employee benefit funds and philanthropic foundations in the UK and South Asia, which in turn owned a plethora of shell companies. The shells served as parking lots for BCCI assets and conduits for transactions that needed to be hidden from the balance sheets of the bank's local branches around the world. In practice, BCCI founder Aga Hassan Abedi and his small circle of deputies controlled the entire flow of money with almost no outside oversight. With each successful delivery, an American hostage was freed in Lebanon, and the intermediaries earned handsome commissions. Once arms profits had been cycled through BCCI's network, real estate was a method of transforming suspicious cash flows into legitimate sales and rental income, while obscuring the true ownership behind layers of shells. BCCI was heavily involved in real estate lending and property purchases through shells and nominees, and Khashoggi himself had massive real estate holdings worldwide, including hotels, ranches, mansions, and commercial properties. Decades before Epstein became a household name, former Israeli intelligence officer Ari Ben-Menash wrote in his 1992 memoir that Barack feared Perez, or the Americans would discover the slush fund bank accounts where the arms profits were hidden and take the money for themselves. Ben-Menash claimed that Barack arranged for media mogul Robert Maxwell, Ghislaine Maxwell's father, to launder the Iran weapons profits through his company's accounts and hide the money in Soviet banks where they could not be touched by the Americans. In 1991, for years after Iran-Contra, Maxwell disappeared from his 180-foot yacht, the Lady Ghislaine, while it cruised off the Canary Islands. Hours later, Spanish authorities recovered his body from the Atlantic. Maxwell's media empire was collapsing under a mountain of debt, and he was secretly siphoning hundreds of millions of pounds sterling from his company's pension funds. When investigators began untangling the books after his death, they found nearly half a billion pounds missing, and possibly more. An email obtained from Epstein's Yahoo inbox, dated October 15, 2005, suggests Ghislaine Maxwell was trying to purchase information about her father's missing fortune from a CIA operative. Maxwell emailed Epstein excitedly while visiting Bhutan for the wedding of Princess Chimi Yangtsam Wangchuk. She wrote Epstein, "The wedding was amazing. Also was with a CIA operative who SD that he worked with Dad. I was so shocked. He SD he could tell, all find all, and reveal all, for a price." Epstein often made vague boasts about being a financial bounty hunter who tracked down hidden money. In 1987, while Robert Maxwell was allegedly hiding money from arms deals, Epstein bragged to a journalist about finding money for Adnan Khashoggi in such detail. The journalist thought Epstein might be in the business of hiding as well as finding it. Logistics man. After the Southern Air transport plane carrying Hazanfus was shot down over Nicaragua on October 5, 1986, the Iran-Contra scheme began to unravel. On October 9th, Hazanfus confessed in a conference before the world's press that he was working with the CIA to ferry weapons to the Contras, secretly backing their war against Nicaragua's leftist government. U.S. officials quickly denied Hazanfus's confession, saying he was on a private mission. Hazanfus passed away in late November of this year. Southern Air Transport, a CIA front, was not only shipping weapons to the Contras. The planes were also carrying weapons to Israel to fuel the brutal war between Iran and Iraq.
Well, I was supposed to stop at that point and... it's pretty discombobulating indeed. And give you a musical break. Again, another song that Trump might sing at his Mar-a-Lago state, or maybe in the new ballroom. The year in rebuke, as I mentioned earlier. For people who are still listening, and the podium is still empty at Mar-a-Lago. That's 40 minutes late. Maybe it is a 3 o'clock presser that Trump's going to do, and my voice is failing again, so here's Harry.
This won't be something I said I would train. Now it's become my preeminent domain. I went into business with a son or two, set up to sell mystery money to you. It's called crypto, though some lunatics call it gypto. It's enriching a special few. It's all dressed up with my personal pomp, just a signal that I am the swamp. I one felon, or maybe more, when a few million bucks came right through my door. My deals once went bust, now my power means trust. And like I say, I own the store. My second term is a lucrative romp. Ain't it obvious that I am the swamp? You know I used to ban Muslims, now I'm best pals with kings. They're investing in some of my favorite things. A hotel in Bahrain, a Qatari jet plane. Just a few examples of what swampdom brings. Enemies get a nice little stomp. For as long as I like, I am the swamp. The swamp.
From Harry Shearer's Year in Rebuke, annual feature of his, he collects all of his satirical pieces through the year and puts them together for our holiday edition, and I recommend it highly. Sends up RFK in a pretty subtle manner. Okay, I'm not going to go back to the drop site piece, because I only got 15 minutes left, and I did say I was going to do something about nuclear issues. I'll mention again, I have an article in a couple of numbers ago, Public Eye. It's online about the microreactor that they're intending to build over on campus at the Abbott Power Plant, right in the middle of town. They're already drilling for aquifer water to cool the bloody thing. My article cites a smile politely by the late Bruce Hannon, who said, "You're going to put it right next to a train track where you could have a train wreck?" I didn't even think of that aspect, but just having it in the middle of town. If they want to test it somewhere else, yeah, right. Well, I don't want to. I oppose it entirely. But in a deregulatory era, well, they should at least be asked to forswear the liability limitation of the Price-Anderson Act, which ought to go out of way, since it's such a mature industry, you know. They don't need to have the taxpayer pay for disasters of a certain amount. They're generally regarded by some as being not insured at all. And they have zombie reactors coming out of retirement up in Palisades, and also, I think, Dresden 1, one of the first nuclear plants to be commercially developed, right on the Illinois River, where the nuclear containment vessel is probably getting embrittled. The nano micro reactor is going to be helium cooled, which just really sounds nuts to me. Helium seeps through a lot of stuff because it's such. Anyway, let's not get to X physics major stuff here. And let's go to Harvey Wasserman's. It's actually kind of, it's a video too. It's a Zoom with maybe 100 people involved, and he choreographs it all. And I thought I'd play a segment of it. And talks about the Palisades plant. It's right on Lake Michigan. What could go wrong? Yeah, this is from Green Power Wellness, which is a weird name for a podcast. It's actually started out as a environmental but also an election protection bit. Wasserman and Fetrakis worked a lot together. Fetrakis did the Yeoman's work on the Epstein connections in Ohio, where Air America, that's not Southern Air Transport, the CIA's transshipping planes, for a while after it got too hot in Miami, or Miami. Okay, let's do a clock check. Oh, yes, barely enough time to get this segment on. In fact, I might slip to Carl Grossman's section. Again, not a physicist, but a great journalist, retired professor. He's been working on the nuclear issue for quite a while.
Kevin Camps. Kevin is, I know you've been on this issue, but you're working on Palisades. Do the numbers that are being calculated here, $5 billion over budget, over market in 5 years, does that resonate at all with Palisades in Michigan?
Yes, I've begun to put some things in the chat, the similarities between Palisades and Diablo. And like Linda said, mostly thus far, I've put in safety-related risks at both that are similar, ironically, even though they're on separate sides. But in terms of money, what I'm most familiar with are the bailouts happening at Palisades. A grand total thus far of $3.52 billion in mostly federal, but also state bailouts at Palisades related to the restart of what is a 60-year-old reactor. And I say that because it was designed in the mid-1960s. Ground was broken in 1967, fired up in 1971. Had a problem-plagued operational history for more than 50 years. It was a lemon from the get-go. There was actually a major lawsuit filed by the utility company against the builder, California-based Bechtel, that resulted in an out-of-court settlement, and then they just fired it up. They didn't fix anything. And so that's what they've gotten thus far, $3.52 billion in public bailouts. But they've asked for more than $8 billion related to the restart alone. And the restart is unprecedented. I mean, I include Diablo 1 and 2 as zombie reactors because they were supposed to have shut. So they're past their life. So they're zombies. But Palisades is in a somewhat different category in that it's closed. And so it's a zombie. They're trying to bring it back from the dead. And that precedent at Palisades is being followed by Three Mile Island Unit 1 and also by Duane Arnold in Iowa. And perhaps other reactors, we're still a bit worried about Kewaunee in Wisconsin, which shut in 2013. And a couple more very ironic zombie reactors would include Indian Point 2 and 3, which Holtec, in its madness a couple months ago, proposed to restart if the state of New York or the federal government will give it $10 billion with a B. And oh, by the way, they've already partially dismantled both of those units. So talk about waste, fraud, and abuse. They're going to get paid $10 billion to rebuild what they've dismantled. So I mentioned more than $8 billion on the restart of Palisades, but at the same time, they want to build two so-called small modular reactors there. Another $7.4 billion requested for the so-called small modular reactors, $400 million of which was just awarded by the Trump Department of Energy a couple weeks ago. That was included in the $3.52 billion figure that I mentioned. So these are financial crimes, except they're legal. They're financial crimes that are legal. But the safety is what we're most concerned about at Palisades. They're risking a Chernobyl. They're risking a Fukushima at Palisades. We've dodged many bullets at Palisades over decades. Not everybody has. For example, the most immediate neighbors to the south, it's a 120-year-old resort community called Palisades Park Country Club, 200 cottages on the lakeshore, 50 thyroid cancers diagnosed, alleged, in a part-time population because people are only there in the warm weather, not in the wintertime. There shouldn't be a single thyroid cancer in that community. At peak summertime population, it's 3,000 people. They have 50 thyroid cancers there. So did Palisades have a fuel failure that we never heard about? You get thyroid cancer from radioactive iodine-137, from cesium isotopes. Did they have failed fuel that they forgot to tell us about that's causing these disease rates?
Unbelievable. It's horrifying. Linda Seeley, in your neighborhood, do you have thyroid cancer to report? And then we'll go to, we're joined by Robert Freeling. He'll come, we'll go to Carl Grossman and then Robert Freeling. And Linda, I know you have to leave.
Joe Mangano did a recent study here, and it's more an increase in leukemia, childhood leukemia, and fetal loss during the first trimester, and birth anomalies, not thyroid cancer.
Okay.
So Yeah, I don't know,
Well, we
but
hope you're well, and you should be passing out potassium iodide anyway to everybody in the region, that's for sure.
absolutely. The only way you can get potassium iodide, by the way, is to physically go to the San Luis Obispo County Health Department and register and pick up your pills. They do not send them out to people. They mention them on the back page of the calendar that PG&E sends out to all PO boxes and addresses in the county in the evacuation area. So most people don't even know. Most people in this county, I would say, don't even know that Diablo Canyon is here. And number two, that nobody knows where to get their medical supplies or their potassium iodide because most people don't read the back page of the free calendar that comes in the mail to you every year.
Well, we got to correct that. We got in 2026, we got to get a campaign going. Everybody in the Diablo region should be taking potassium iodide. Absolutely.
And
Whether
then
we hope
they
we
actually
place.
may become concerned, you know, the residents will become concerned if they did
Right.
that.
Well, let's do that. Let's deal with that. And we'll talk about it again in January next year. And we need to find a governor candidate. There are six or seven Democrats, two Republicans. One of them has got to take up this issue in this campaign. So let's
Which
see what
Katie Porter was actually opposed to the extension, the SB 846 that extended Diablo by the state legislature for 5 years. She was
happens.
opposed to it, as was Barbara Lee.
Okay, let's deal with that. That's good. Thank you, Linda.
Yeah.
Carl Grossman in New York, and then we'll go to Robert Freeling, who's back here in California. Money was a very, very big issue in the prevention of the Shoreham reactors from going online. Can you give us some of the numbers that really took root there and helped shut Shoreham? Carl Grossman is one of the godfathers of the No Nukes movement. He's speaking to us from Long Island, where he just retired from a three-century career as a professor of journalism. But go ahead, Carl.
Yeah, well, in terms of a catastrophic accident with, well, it would be the Shoreham nuclear power plant, the first of 7 to 11 nuclear power plants planned for Long Island, would be immense. It's an island with millions of people, no way to evacuate and so forth. But if anybody is interested in numbers, whether it's Diablo Canyon or other nuclear power plants in the United States, the U.S. government, they'll never do it again, but in 1982, Sandia National Laboratories for the government put together a report called Calculation of Reactor Accident Consequences. The acronym is CRAC-2. And again, looked at every nuke in this country in operation then or proposed to be built. And if you go to Diablo, and I'll put in the chat in 2 minutes, if you go to Diablo, just go under D, peak early fatalities, 10,000 for Diablo Canyon 1, 10,000 for Diablo Canyon 2, peak early injuries, 12,000 for 1, or no, 11,000 for 1, 12,000 for 2, peak cancer deaths, 12,000 for each of them. And in terms of property damage, again, this is the government, an official report. I'll put the link in a sec.
What year, Carl? What year was it?
1982.
Carl Grossman and Harvey Wasserman, two intrepid anti-nuclear activists. And you can find that at Green Power Wellness or Green Power ES, or just search for Wasserman. Grossman's not a physicist, but he is good on some of these issues. Opinions you hear are those of the speakers. I somehow didn't find Trump giving his press conference, but he is doing one right now. And the parts I heard were like an emetic for me, so I have to go and deal with that. Nuclear issues. I've got the piece up at the number 2 ago at the Public Eye. I also want to commend your attention to the article on anti-Semitism by three activists locally with the CU Jews for Ceasefire, given the fact that Mamdani is getting a lot of flack for rescinding a Adams passed executive directive about accepting certain definitions of anti-Semitism that include things like being opposed to Israeli policy, being anti-Zionist, of which there are many Jews that are anti-Zionist, and I like to play them when I can. And let's kick it with the Funkadelic and a, oh yeah, I believe Gus is fired up. He's going to let it rip here on WEFT, Champaign-Urbana, listener-sponsored and volunteer-operated radio. Thanks for being here. Thanks for supporting community media. We need it now more than ever.